Hello, this is David Rovix hosting another live stream broadcast, which is appearing on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, Cable Community Radio, and various other platforms. Since the pandemic hit and I had to stop touring, I've taken to interviewing people of interest live on the internet, which as of this week is an activity I'm mainly doing on Tuesdays, as well as most Wednesdays and Fridays at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Belfast, along with various other live streaming and podcasting activities, including a concert on the last Saturday of the month, which this month will be a live streamed recording session at Big Red Studio. Every Tuesday, the broadcast has an actual producer, longtime Detroit area talk show host and Fifth Estate Magazine editorial collective member, Peter Werby. These days, Fifth Estate is a quarterly print magazine that has been published in one form or another since its founding in 1965. The summer issue is hot off the presses. My copy just arrived in the mail a few days ago. You can subscribe to it at fifthestate.org and hear previous episodes of Fifth Estate Live there as well. Today, for the second half of the show, we'll be talking with several people, all involved with putting together the upcoming Fifth Estate Anarchist Review of Books. We'll start for the first half of the show just talking with one of those co-editors, award-winning novelist and regular Fifth Estate contributor who has also written for a wide array of other publications, including the New York Times, the Paris Review, and Rolling Stone. Her most recent piece, published a couple weeks ago in the Daily Beast, is a spellbinding introduction to an alternate universe titled The Anarchist Neighborhood of Athens. Kara Hoffman, welcome to Fifth Estate Live. It's great to have you with
me. Great to be here, David. Thank you for having me on.
So I just, that article you wrote about Exarchia in Athens is just so wonderful. And as with, as with so many things, it just seems especially relevant today with all the efforts that are going on in various places to create autonomous zones of one form or another, generally being violently repressed, as often is the case. But I mean, it sure helps to have some kind of experience with how a society can be done differently to be able to sort of have a vision for doing that elsewhere, huh? What was it that you lived there for quite a while in Exarchia?
I'm living in Exarchia.
Or you live there now?
Yeah, I live there now. I'm back in the States just briefly, and we'll be going back again in October. It's very interesting. It's neighborhood of Exarchia, for people who don't know, is a neighborhood that's been anarchist occupied for the past 47 years. And it was kind of amazing to come back to the United States at a time when there's so much, I guess we could say, civil unrest, a moment of uprising that's happening here. And I think that there are many differences between what's happening here in the U.S. and what happened in Greece in 1973 that allowed for the neighborhood to become what it was. And I think that we as people who are involved in resistance activities or involved in politics or involved in anarchism, there are a lot of lessons for us to take from what's happening continually and what's happened in Greece. Certainly, I feel like there's a big difference between Exarchia and CHOP, mostly because things structurally are different in the U.S. and in Greece politically.
I mean, in Greece, in Athens, we're talking about a very large neighborhood and a whole lot of different buildings with, I mean, just to paint a picture of the extent of it, which is just so far beyond anything like CHOP, a hotel taken over by anarchists squatted for the purposes of housing hundreds of refugees. And that's just one of the buildings in Exarchia, right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly. There are the neighborhood has a whole bunch of solidarity houses and squats, places that people have, abandoned buildings that people have taken over that offer support for refugees and migrants and people who are homeless and people who want to live in a different way. So, and that's been a long process. You know, in the 70s and 80s, there were 10,000 anarchists who were living in this one neighborhood, and it's about the size of Alphabet City in New York City. And so, and it's been autonomous and self-directed for a long time. That doesn't mean that there aren't moments where the police come in or where there aren't skirmishes with the police. It's just that they are able to maintain, they're able to maintain, frankly. I mean, the place has, you know, shops and restaurants and pay what you can cafes, and it's kind of an amazing public art and like a boom of you know, music and art and things like that that happened that sort of kept the neighborhood culturally unified. And I think also it's we see with Chop, I was very excited, actually, of course we all were, when we were seeing things like autonomous zones arise in different places in the U.S. And I think that I'm not sure exactly. Well, I have different theories as to why it's not as simple to just declare a place an autonomous zone and keep things going here. Chop closed down relatively quickly and violently. And so I think part of what is interesting about the situation in Exarchia is that things are structurally set up in Greece in such a tremendously different way than they are here. I mean, for example, like even now, New Democracy, the government run by Mitsotakis now in Greece, is always referred to as the right-wing government. But if you look at the actual policies of that government, they're far, far to the left of anything that we experience here, right? So they
right and left have different meanings in the European context. I mean, a right-wing party in Europe still believes in universal health care for all their citizens, right?
Absolutely. So we have, you have a right-wing government that may be doing, there is without a doubt crackdowns. There are without a doubt things going on to do. Evacuate squats and try to evacuate the squats, but the government itself is not as authoritarian as the U.S. government right now.
In Exarchia, one of the things that I think is particularly notable in the context of a lot of the discussion that's going on now in the U.S. is when you mentioned, it wasn't a totally police-free zone. I mean, it was in the sense like that when if police came in, it was basically to cause chaos. And right, I mean, it wasn't like they were enforcing laws in the sense that they would be doing that in a more normal neighborhood. I mean, in a sense, it was kind of a police-free zone, would you say?
I'm not sure I understand. When the police come into Exarchia, I think that they, in their minds, have reasons to be coming into Exarchia. They just are pretty rapidly pushed out again. There's a high level of organization, I think, and also just a high level of willingness, people willing to fight the police and to, throw tear gas back at the police and to do all the things that we're seeing right now in the U.S. I don't want to say that that's not happening here, because we are seeing it in Portland. We are seeing it in Seattle. We did see it in Seattle. Those things are happening.
For the people who are the suburban types who are worried about the whole concept of not having a police department, I know that there might not be a lot of them viewing this particular interview. However, just in case there are some, what would you say to them, like in terms of having lived in a place where you don't have, police enforcing laws in the sense that the suburbanites are. Hoping to have the police available to call when they need help. You know what I mean?
Well, I think very few people have an experience of living in places in a place that is self-directed or experiencing even a small, like I think about I think about Hakim Bey who coined the phrase temporary autonomous zone. And so we think about what is it to be autonomous? What is it to have something, even if it's small? I think he uses like the smallest form of it as like the dinner party, where people are not having there's no hierarchy going on. And what does that feel like? And I don't think very many people anywhere really have the experience of living in a place that's not hierarchical, where they're not going to appeal to some authority to have something resolved for them. And I think when you're living in anarchist spaces, the idea is that we are all responsible for what goes on there. We are all infinitely responsible for one another and for what goes on there. So if we have a problem with homelessness, if we have a problem with people who don't have access to food, if we have those kinds of problems, those are things that we need to resolve, right? So in Exarchia, I live next to a squat that actually it ended up being evacuated, but they had free showers and free laundry every Sunday. So everybody could come there and they could do their laundry, or they could take a shower, they could use the water, they could do whatever they wanted to do. And you have, you know, and then you have other, you know, groups and other solidarity houses that take care of different aspects, like feeding people, housing people, letting people use whatever facilities they need to use, educating people, you know, language classes, music classes, all kinds of different classes like that. And then medical, like collectives, people taking care of those things for one another. And that is because people in the community took responsibility to do those things. And we see these things in the United States, certainly, right? I mean, I think we can actually look to, though we don't often agree with them, we can look to how the Christian right, frankly, often really engages very well in taking care of people in their communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have different sort of charitable organizations or even things that they wouldn't necessarily want to talk about being horizontally organized, that they actually do function that way. And certainly there's a lot of that going on in Exarchia. And I think it might sound utopian, but I think really when you get down to it, it's just a matter of a lot of hard work and people who've decided that they're going to do that work because it's fulfilling for them. Yeah.
It particularly sounds utopian to anybody who hasn't lived in a community like that. But of course, there are there are autonomous communities like Exarchia in many different countries at different points, and sometimes they last for decades, and they're often attacked by the police. But a whole bunch of land occupation is happening in Argentina now once again.
Sure, absolutely, and even in the U.S., you have, I mean, there's certainly a number of intentional communities, right, that are probably collectively run. I think the difference is like, you know, Exarchia feels a bit like a city within a city, and it's urban and it's decay. And, you know, quite frankly, it's beautiful too. You know, when you see the actual neighborhood, I think it's, there's a romance to the beauty of that place. But I also don't want to talk, I don't want to make it sound too romantic, because certainly there are fights with the police, there's tear gas, there's all kinds of things that are very unpleasant about being there. And
And that which kind of in many ways, that kind of conflict and that kind of being under threat it partially is what creates such a powerful special atmosphere in a place, in an autonomous place like that, right? You never know what's going to happen tomorrow, right?
Right. And we're fighting to maintain a place that has been there for almost 50 years. I mean, we're fighting to maintain the beauty of that place, right? We're fighting to maintain the beauty of the idea that we can live together, and that we've been sort of sold this bill of goods about how that's impossible, or how it's not human nature. And I think Exarchia stands as a really clear example that it's human nature that people cooperate. It's human nature that people take responsibility for their environments. And I think I certainly would encourage, you know, anybody to research it, to look into it, anybody interested in autonomous politics or anarchist politics, to look deeply at Exarchia as an example.
And, you know, in your article, I mean, one thing I wanted to ask about and kind of flesh out a little in the context of a lot of the urban combat, I guess, more like police riots, really, that's been going on all over the United States over the past few months, sometimes turning into something that looks a bit more like a a European riot, but mostly it's just police attacking people. But having spent a lot of time in Europe, I know that like when there's when these kinds of when police attack a neighborhood like Exarchia and the kind of resistance that goes on, the scale of it, we're often talking about thousands of people or tens of thousands sometimes defending neighborhoods and going on the attack against the police and against the state. And this is, I don't know, it takes on a whole different scale. And I don't know, I've often thought that maybe a lot of that, the reason it's able to take on such a scale is because of having being in a society that has more potential for popular democracy and more potential control over the state by the people. And the police tend not to be armed. And at least I'm not sure about Greece, but most of the countries I've been to in Europe, the police are, they only carry guns when there's gun crime involved. And otherwise they're not carrying guns. So you kind of know when you have these massive, like medieval combat situations that like, it reminds me of the Game of Thrones, you know? I mean, I was in Rostock in 2007 and many other places, and it's just like, it's, you see the projectiles going overhead too, but they're not it's not the stuff that they're firing here. It's more like flares, and the police are using truncheons, and they're of course they're dressed in riot gear. And but yeah, I mean, bones are broken and it's very dangerous and lots of people are injured and people can get killed, but it's so different in many ways. And I wonder if you could just talk, this quote that you quoted in your article, you quote somebody named Maria talking about what was going on in 2008 after the teenager was killed there in Athens. And she says, "The day we don't tear things down because the government murdered a child is the day we're no longer human."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's referring to in 2008, Alexander Grigopoulos, this young man, well, this teenager, who spent his time in Exarchia and was involved in anarchist politics, was murdered by the police. And there were riots that spread throughout the entire country. And that you know, push pretty much was like the second huge push to make sure that the police were totally outside of Exarchia. The first push happened in 1973, and this was like the second huge wave of that. And obviously, like what she says is, you know, she speaks for her, you know, for herself and for everybody, that sentiment is how we should all be living, right? You know, when we allow for the state to murder a child, and she was also saying that because in the American press, she was reading comments that said, "How could the Greeks riot like this over just one child?"
Hmm.
And I think that actually has more to do, especially in Greece, with the kind of traditional understanding of how family works. Another thing I was writing about in the article is that the reason that they handled COVID, they've been handling COVID so well, is that people have this real commitment to taking care of one another and commitment to taking care of their families, right? People live together in multi-generation houses, and they're not going to be doing things that are risky if they're going to be risking lives of their parents or their grandparents. And I think that's a traditional Mediterranean value. It's also a traditional anarchist value. And to your point that things are different, I mean, certainly like in the United States right now, we have a highly militarized police force, right? We have police, police in the tiniest towns needing military vehicles and SWAT teams and things like that. I think that we see in protests this extreme militarization on the street. It's not that you don't see police with guns in Exarchia. It's not that you don't see them using tear gas or doing things that are violent, really violent. It's just that the level of violence in the United States is higher, right? The level of the acceptance that we have that things are going to get violent, the acceptance that we have that disobey a cop, you could end up dead. That's really a part of our psyche. That's really a part of our understanding, and it's an accurate part of our understanding how our police, our police are National Guard, how they work, right? And in Greece, the initial uprising that created Exarchia, basically, was the military going in and murdering people in the Polytechnic Institute. And so that was what put things, that was what created this revolutionary moment that put things into motion. And we do not necessarily, have something like that going on in the United States. We had this big push after George Floyd, and we had this, what looks like a revolutionary moment. But I think what we're also seeing is like incrementally like a fact that is coming in waves, really.
You're breaking up just a bit. Incrementally, a crackdown, did you say?
Yes, in the U.S., I'm thinking, you know, like after George, we saw this sort of revolutionary movement with George Floyd, but we also saw a pretty immediate kind of crackdown. And, you know, we can talk about what we think is coming next, but I think it's really hard to predict. It's a really volatile moment here.
Right. It's a terrible thing that kind of asking such a question. I mean, I always ask my guests near the end of interviews, usually, if they have predictions for the next few weeks or the next few months. But it's a terrible question because, you know, I mean, it gets people talking and usually ends up with interesting comments. But there's such a vast number of possible factors, right? It's so hard to even predict tomorrow with all that's happening every hour. You know.
Yes. I would say that the political situation and COVID have certainly made me a lot less likely to offer any kind of projection about what we're going to even be seeing next month. I mean, that and like, you know, we're living in this crucible, right? We've got climate change and we've got political change and unrest, and we have these police crackdowns, and you know, we have a police force that's largely sympathetic to, if not, you know, connected to white supremacist gangs. I mean, it's really, things are I don't feel like anything's like stable enough for us to make any prediction here.
No. You know, one of the things I read, I think it was in 2012, when Golden Dawn in Greece was polling at around 7%, I think. But as I read at the time, when people vote in Greece, they vote according to their workplaces rather than their residences. And so it became common knowledge at that time that the police were voting about 50% for the fascist party. And that was very interesting, but generally, and I mean, which it seems like that tells you a lot, I think, about the mentality of cops generally and who joins police forces in a lot of countries, not just Greece, right? I think it's a bit of an indication there, which we don't generally get in a lot of, I don't know how often we get things broken down statistically so simply, like half of them vote for the fascists. But but it seems like in Europe, one of the things that happens is there's historically with more of a stronger left that has managed to create multi-party democracies, as flawed as they are. It seems like, having spent a lot of time there, it seems like it's important to note how much better things are in so many ways in the multi-party democracies that compared to our, you know, two-party duopoly state.
Absolutely. The idea of having this sort of ridiculous, like, false binary that we choose from every 4 years, it seems just so silly when you look at how other, you know, whatever, other Western democracies are doing things. And I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't want to skip the state radio. I'm not going to start talking about electoral politics here. But
there are differences. I mean, I think as an anarchist, I still feel like it's really important to note these differences. Capitalism isn't necessarily the same everywhere, you know?
Absolutely. Also, like, I think the more that we have the system where it's like, oh, it's going to be a really close election. It's going to be so close. We, you know, we won't be able to call it. But, you know, we won't figure out what's going on forever. And, you know, we have, you know, party A or party B. And, you know, there's this idea, I mean, there's, you know, this is the idea that every democracy is going to eventually necessitate a Holocaust, you know, every democracy like the kind that we have. You know, I think it's, you know, like, I'm thinking of like Giorgio Agamben, I'm thinking about reading texts like that in been thinking very seriously about what does it mean? Like, what kind of system is this actually? When we have only these two products represented, essentially. Yeah.
But then in Greece, you had a movement where coming out of the movements around the financial crisis and everything, there was a third party rose to power. And then what happened to them? Before we move on to stage two of the program, I know that you touched on this in your article as well, but I mean, just briefly, but what happened to Syriza? There was a lot of people had a lot of hope.
Syriza Party is traditionally, it's largely considered sympathetic with anarchists, a party that was sympathetic to the anarchist socialist party. And that was, many people believe that Exarchia was really left alone. And the people, of course, who were opposed to the idea of Exarchia believe that Exarchia was sort of encouraged to exist or indulged by the fact that Syriza, by the Syriza government, or that, you know, people who, family members of Syriza government were anarchists. And so that was why the anarchist stronghold was left alone. But I think that more and more, so it was in July, they were voted out, and the new government is, certainly looks more like the American corporate business government, right? It's like Mitsotakis, he's Harvard educated, he's a businessman, he's sort of like a, you know, legacy kind of politician. And so that's who's there now. And I would encourage everybody to, you know, to read the Daily Beast article and to look more, you know, it's more than I can actually say right now on the show, but to read the article and to also, you know, to look into Exarchia if you're interested. These are things that we should definitely be looking at. And I do want to say again that the New Democracy, even though it's awful, right? Like, it's awful that New Democracy won. I'm really upset about it. However, it's absolutely nothing like even Biden winning in the U.S. And that's right. Really important for people to understand. Nothing like it.
Like even the right wing, I mean, that's putting the things into context. I always like to mention like that even the most right wing government in all of Europe, nobody spends more than 2.5% of their national budget on the military.
Yeah.
And if anybody suggested, I think we should cut all the social services and spend half our money on the military like the U.S. does, they'd never get voted back into power.
Yeah, anyway. And healthcare. I mean, I think healthcare is that people aren't held in kind of a hostage situation like they are in the U.S., right? Where you know, your healthcare, all the things that the government here is supposed to be providing for you, they're not, right? I mean, the purpose of a government, right, one would think is to be protected. And if that's not happening, why would you be loyal to it? Why would you pay attention to any of the laws? What would you do? Would you have anything to do with it? You know, you're not getting health care. You don't have, you know, a pension guarantee. You're,
But that's another difference between Europe and the U.S. is people in Europe kind of like they don't mind filing filing papers with bureaucracies because it usually means they're going to get something in, you know, out of it. You know, it's not like you're just some black hole of like, yeah.
Sure. And the quality of the health, I can say definitively, right, for having lived there for a while now, the quality in the healthcare is night and day to what it is here. And the, you know, the quality of life, the food, I mean, we could go on and on and on with like the different ways that the American government is destroying people's lives and not creating any kind of
no. We just spend money on destruction.
Yeah.
But it's sort of awkwardly moving on to the second half. Like, I don't know how to make transitions. I have no experience with transit. At least as a performer, you finish the song, they applaud, and then, you know, it's easy, you know. But
it's not so awkward, David, because we're going to be talking to Ellie Arbor, who's in Rochester right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Shall we just bring on our other guests and introduce them as we go? You're all co-editors of the Fifth Estate Anarchist Review of Books. And I was gonna ask you all if you've read any good books lately. But can we actually first maybe talk about what's been going on in Rochester? Ellie Arbour, you're a wonderful hip hop artist and writer in Rochester. Although you actually live in Austin these days, but you're back in Rochester serendipitously at this very moment. And Carrie Laban, you're a award-winning novelist as well. We have two award-winning novelists here, and with confusingly similar names, but I'm not going to mess up anymore. And you're in Queens, New York, right now as well. And I was going to ask Kara if she could sort of co-host this segment with me, but I wonder can we start with a little perspective on what's been going on in Rochester for the few days. It looks a hell of a lot like Portland lately, and this riot zones being declared every night and all that.
So it's been interesting because there's the sort of overarching media narrative, and I guess this happens with any kind of situation, is there's a lot of context that's missing from it, right? Basically, as a timeline, so this whole thing started in March. So March 23rd, Daniel Prude's brother came into town, or came into Rochester, and he called the police, and they did an MHA, a mental health arrest, and they all went to the hospital because he was having like a kind of a psychotic episode. So he's assessed at the hospital. They didn't assess him to be a risk, so they all went home. So later that night, or like way later that night, like around 3 a.m., the brother calls the police again because of, you know, another mental health episode. So, and, you know, he's obviously, to say calling the police is a bit of a misnomer because all, you know, 911 is the number that you call for every emergency, right? So calls... The police show up. Daniel Prude is, most people know this, naked in the street, having this sort of mental break, this psychotic episode. The cops, you know, handcuff him, no problem. He's compliant, but he's obviously, you know, escalated. And basically what happens is, this is like right at the start of COVID. So the cop puts, you know, according to the cop, puts the hood over the, puts the hood on Daniel Prude. And then basically what happens next is the cop leverages all his body weight and pushes his head into the cement for 3 minutes while another cop like is kneeling on his back. So he loses, his heartbeat stops, he goes motionless. And the video is, you know, you can see it anywhere. It's not even, it's graphic, but I feel like every video we've seen is graphic. And I don't want to say that to discount anything, but this one's especially gratuitous because of the sound and because of how much video there is. It's almost every single cop at the scene. I think there's four or five different body cameras that are running simultaneously, and they're picking up all the audio, and the things that they're saying are they're mocking him. They're like making jokes the whole time. Like they're treating the whole situation very callously. They're able to resuscitate him at the scene, but he's brain dead. So on March 30th, they take him off life support. They take him off life support and he passes. Fast forward to August 20th. No one knows about this. Like this didn't make the news in Rochester. Like no one knew about this. May 24th, I believe, is the day that George Floyd was killed. And that was sort of the flashpoint for all the earlier killings in the area, the Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. And I think that was really the flashpoint. And then fast forward to August 20th, the family of Daniel Prude is finally able to get the tape because of a Freedom of Information Act request. So they're finally able to get all the body cam footage, which they released on September 2nd, which was last Wednesday. So basically the city, when that came out, everything just kind of layers started getting pulled backwards. Like the mayor knew about it and the police chief knew about it. And all these people who were at very top levels of government were aware of what had happened and didn't tell anybody. And the family didn't even know what happened because the cops didn't tell them.
The family didn't even get all that audio and all that video. That wasn't part of the thing before it became public.
They didn't get any of that until August 20th. So for almost 6 months, the family was in the dark about what had actually happened. They're getting whatever story they're getting they weren't out watching. They didn't see it. Whatever story they're getting is whatever the police told them, whatever the official report is. But nobody sees this video for six months between March and August. Nobody sees it. So they're going off what the police told them, but they're trying to get this Freedom of Information Act request, and nobody can get anything. So once they finally get it, they have a chance to review it. And I mean, it's so much. It's such a damning scene because you have all of this, these five officers. It's not just the one officer on the scene. It's five officers on the scene, and you have all their body camera footage, plus extra officers who show up afterwards. So you get sort of wide angles. So there's no, like, this is one of those situations where there's no question, and the officers weren't put on leave until last week, I believe. The officers have been working the whole time and then are just now on paid leave. So it's this situation where everybody, the police know what happened explicitly. They've seen the video. The mayor claims she didn't see the video. The attorney general has had this case since April 20th, I believe, is when she picked it up. But that's still a full month after everything happened. And there's just this evidence of this cover-up that's so profound and so I guess unjustifiable in any regard. And it's become a flashpoint in a city where this is something that's needed to happen and has been coming for a long time. Sorry, I don't want to talk too much about
And Ellie, you're writing about this for the review. Tell us a little bit about how you're contextualizing this for ARB.
So Rochester has a really bad history with race, right? In a longer sense. Rochester was never built as a city for minorities. Like, that just wasn't what it was, but it was different than the, a lot of cities in the North didn't have huge black populations, but Rochester was unique among sort of the cities in the North during the Great Migration, in that Rochester was extremely resistant to black people and people of color moving into the city. And also Rochester had two businesses that essentially the entire city was prosperous as, some of the Levittown style suburbs that began popping up around that time, because Rochester had Kodak and Rochester had Xerox.
And unions, mostly union jobs, right?
Exactly. All union jobs. Like, you could leave high school, work in a factory and live, the full American dream in Rochester. But for blacks and mainly, especially blacks who were coming here after the, during the Great Migration, they couldn't get a job anywhere. So Rochester has had these moments since, there was a riot in 64, and we've had, these periodic moments where, these groups have risen up and out of these sort of flashpoints, we've made huge changes. Like, there's an organization called Fight, which was the big local, the civil rights organization in Rochester. They're the ones who basically, in order to get Kodak to hire black workers, they got a bunch of their white sympathizers to buy stock in Kodak. So they basically stormed and took over a Kodak shareholders meeting and were basically like, okay, so you're going to start hiring people of color, or we're going to come back in an hour and we're taking over this meeting. And that's what they did. And that was what really pushed Kodak not only to start hiring black people, but Kodak specifically didn't make film that could capture darker skin until, the latter half of the 20th century, it was explicitly like they just didn't care. And so those are the types of things that you don't really think about, but they're, as you get older and you learn more about your city and just being from a small town in general, you learn about these small changes that are woven into your own identity, but that have affected a lot of people at large, right?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just gonna say it's fascinating. I mean, I'm looking forward to the piece, and I'm looking forward to you. I mean, the continuing reporting that you're doing.
It's a strange time, and it's been a long time coming. The other people are extremely unsatisfied with the mayor and some decisions that she made over the summer that people, I'm not going to say whether or not they are racially motivated. A lot of people perceive them as racially motivated. They were pushed as issues of safety, but a lot of people felt as if they were much more issues of sort of community management in a more sinister sense. Rochester's been under curfew for 4 months now. A lot of that's been used to justify the police sort of sending protesters home is, one, Rochester's been under curfew for the past few months not because of any of the protests or anything. Rochester's been under curfew because when the bars up here and stuff have started to open back up, because the COVID cases have been pretty low percentage-wise. New York State's been really good about that. But there were a few shootings over a span of time. And so the mayor instituted a curfew, so essentially a state of emergency, used it as an excuse to make a curfew, where you can't have gatherings of 5 or more outside or 10 or more in private dwellings between hours of, I think it's 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. But that doesn't apply to bars. That doesn't apply to bars or restaurants. It only applies to like being outside or being in your own house.
And so, I'm wondering if we could transition. I mean, seems like a good point.
Yeah, a
transition talking about Carrie's writing.
I told you an hour is not much time.
Yeah, and Carrie's writing about emergency response related to to COVID and to other things that are going on right now. Anarchist emergency response. And I'm wondering if Carrie, you could talk a little bit about what you're going to be writing for Fifth Estate, having to do with that solidarity work.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So this actually, it's pretty applicable to not only what Ellie was talking about, but what Kara was talking about earlier, in that, you know, the idea that keeps people attached to government, I think, is really that government is going to do something for you. And usually the first and foremost thing government is supposed to be doing for you is protecting you from, you know, from foreign governments or from, you know, domestic, you know, whatever criminals or violent people are supposed to be out there. And since the U.S. government does very little in the way of actually helping people, they have to really ramp up the fear of what you won't be protected from if they're not around, which is kind of a classic abusive relationship thing. So my first piece of work, and something I hope to return to a lot in ARB, is really putting it out there for people who don't, you know, there are a lot of people who like the idea, they like freedom and they like the idea of anarchism, but they're just like, oh, it could never work. And showing concretely how it could work, both how the current system isn't working, but also positive examples of how, for instance, I'm writing about how under the current circumstance of the pandemic, you know, mutual aid has been discussed in a way and in formats that I have never seen it discussed before by people who aren't really especially politically aware. And it's taking really simple, concrete forms that everyone can appreciate of, oh, hey, I know my neighbors are elderly or ill, so I'll pick up groceries for them instead of them having to go out and get groceries. Or, you know, I have to, you know, get X amount of yogurt, so I'll get X plus one and give some to somebody who needs it. Or things of that nature. Walking dogs for people who are really worried about going outside. We've seen all of this in New York. And then we've also seen really, you know, kind of sneaky attempts to co-opt that into fear and onto, oh, the most important thing you can do is enforce to your neighbors that they have to comply with this and comply with that, which has resulted in, you know, I'm just as frustrated as anyone else with the fact that people are politicizing wearing masks and things like that. But when you look at the history of using the government using the pretext of health to enforce all sorts of weird stuff, it's not surprising that this has cropped up. And there are people who have a great deal of distrust for real reasons. And that's a big part of, what I'm trying to get across is some of these fears that you have about what will happen when the government's not there to protect you are not real, or are the government's just making it worse.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm trying to work on. And in a larger sense, I really see ARB as something that, like the late great Ursula Le Guin would say, is creating this sense of possibility for people. You know, just like the divine right of kings seemed inevitable until it wasn't, capitalism seems inevitable until it isn't.
Absolutely. Yeah, so well said. So well said. I'm also very excited about ARB, the Anarchist Review of Books, because I feel like there's, and we've talked about this a little bit in our collective meetings, that there's like a lot of gatekeeping about the way information gets put out in the world. And that includes information about literature, that includes information about art, the way that we talk about it always within a particular, I would say, like capitalist, neoliberal context. And so it's really exciting to me to be working with the two of you, as well as the rest of our collective. We have a number of really fantastic people in the collective. And just knowing that we're going to be able to have these kinds of ideas in the magazine, and that we're going to be reviewing the books that we're reviewing and looking at the things that we're looking at. I want to echo what Carrie is saying. It feels like a moment of possibility. And it feels like a moment of possibility for publishing too. It feels like a moment of possibility for radical publishing right now, where people are allowed to say things that they weren't before. We're allowed to talk about being anarchists and to contextualize that properly, to correct people when they are thinking, that anarchists are people going around destroying things. And
the sense of that anarchy is about art and about joy and about beauty. And of course, it's not just about those things. It's not just an aesthetic movement, but that there is a space for those things within anarchism, I think, is really important and often doesn't come across to the general public. It's just, very dour people wearing black and being cranky. And that's not true at all.
even though David's wearing all black.
And tear gas does make you cranky.
I've heard that sometimes they wear red in our cranky.
Yeah, we can wear red and black too.
Yeah, it's true. But yeah, well said. I mean, very well said, Carrie. I think it's an interesting moment where we're hearing the word anarchist. The president is saying the word anarchist. We're hearing the word anarchist tossed around an awful lot, and very, very few people seem to know exactly what that means. And I think part of the good thing about putting out this publication is being able to contextualize that and make that make sense for people.
And, I was thinking also, all three of you write incisive political analysis and this sort of thing in the form of articles and that sort of thing. But your all primary occupations, fair to say, is novelists and hip-hop artists. And these are all not the same form of writing as sort of incisive political analysis of the sort that you might write in The Fifth Estate. And I'm just wondering if that might be just a little bit of a topic to explore, why those avenues of expression?
Well, for sure, my primary interest is in genre fiction, fantasy, horror, science fiction to some extent. And those things have always been about, showing other possibilities that are supposed to be impossible in the current world. So that's really where it all ties together for me. I want to show completely different possibilities.
And that is perhaps oftentimes best done through fiction, you think? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because if you're looking at the real world, you're constrained by the fact that the practical examples of anarchist society thus far that we have to offer are often relatively small, often bounded by time and space in a way that people are like, oh, you can't extrapolate that, but you can do anything in fiction. So
when you're creating like a fictional world, are you often modeling it closely on some aspect of the real world and trying to make it different enough that it's not recognizable what you're talking about, or are you more creating something totally new in a sense?
For my personal work, I generally set it more or less in the real world with just one thing different, whether it's the presence of the supernatural or whether it's an alternate history type of thing. So it's usually very closely modeled on the real world with just a little twist.
And I would really recommend everybody read Carrie's book, A Hawk in the Woods, which I think is it's probably one of my favorite books published in the last, 10 or 15 years. Incredible, bizarre, amazing work of feminist, strange, gorgeous, horrifying fiction that, A Hawk in the Woods by Carrie Laban, really fantastic book. And I also, to plug my fellow R members, Ellie's album, A Place You Can't Find, is really extraordinary. And I think really actually so timely. I was talking about it this morning with someone, the song that you have actually about Rochester on that album, how it's become, it's become even more prescient and more of a, emotional thing to listen to. And so I would really recommend that everybody look at this work and listen to this work. It's beautiful, it's radical, but it's deeply creative. Ellie, do you want to talk a little bit about your work?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we'll start with David's question about why music. I think that there is a certain complete idea that you can get through music, in the sense of you have a word, like the word, which is the actual lyrics, and you have the emotional complement to it, which is the music itself, right? In a lot of, in music, you don't have context in the same way, I guess. Like what you're giving to a person is, and this is the same way in a lot of things that aren't just like rote political discourses, what you're giving to the person, it doesn't matter what you wanted it to be or what you thought it was. When they get it, they're going to interpret it how they can. So the best you can do is give them like a complete emotional idea. And for me, it's a lot about like humanizing topics, right? Like I don't like listening to a lot of like hyper political rap because I can pick up a book and read the same words, right? It's, you listen to music because you want to get a different experience for humanity, but they're also, it's about like making honest examples of these things that you're talking about every day, right? Like my background is in African-American studies and like art and education and linguistics. And it's like, well, I can write a song about a black veteran who comes home from, World War II and still has to sit at the back of a bus. And you're getting the exact same amount of information, but one, you can see a person as opposed to just the numbers that are often just kind of thrown at racism or at these ideas.
I think we're all dealing with, in our creative work anyway, with the idea of creating spaces for empathy, right? Creating spaces for, to relate to feel empathy. Yeah.
And telling one story, it's so powerful, and people can relate to a human life so much more easily than they can relate to like a community or like a city or, exactly, something much bigger. Yeah.
And that's the reason, any of us do, that's the reason people do, interviews. Nobody, the news would be super boring if everything was just based on polls. It's like, how do you guys feel about this? And it's like 80% of people say no. And it's, like statistics are great. But I think one of the things that gets lost, especially, I only have like understanding of things from an American context, but especially in a lot of like national news and just the fact that we are technically a republic of all these different states that have all these ideas, is what gets lost is the human factor of it, right? People can easily say, this many people voted for Trump, or this many people attended a Biden rally or, you know, this many people were at a Yankees game, but that doesn't mean anything. And it dehumanizes all of us. And I think what's important in art is to remind people that every number has a unique life behind it, right? Mm-hmm. And every statistic is, it's not just 50,000 people, it's 50,000 Jonathan, Susan's, Jamal's, Shanice's, all these different people. And it's just, I guess, I mean, all of us, I think our role is to make sure that it doesn't get lost in translation, right?
So well said. Mm.
Yeah. Carrie, anything to add to that? I think, I'm sure you do. It's just such a universal thought, but do you have more?
Well, yeah, I almost hate to follow that up because it's very perfectly said, but yeah, and I think there's sort of a alchemy that happens between the ability of imagination to personalize and the idea of imagination to, as I was saying earlier, create things that haven't been yet or maybe never will be. That's really powerful. And I think, you know, not to speak for everyone, but for me, you know, if we can get that across to any extent in the Anarchist Review of Books, that's going to be, you know, a huge success for us.
Well, it's our motto, right? All power mm-hmm. to the imagination. So that's where we're going.
You know, something my friend David Solnit, who's been involved with organizing a lot of different demonstrations among other activities, and he always takes the position in the organizing committee that everybody should, everybody who's getting on the stage should do something in some cultural form, whether it's a skit or a song or a poem or something like that. And then he usually ends up, you know, compromising at 50-50 speeches and more artistic forms of expression. But I love that because it just seems like if you're trying to communicate, you can't just, you know, talk about statistics and like textbook type of communication. It's so ineffective compared to using so many other means.
It's so corporate. I mean, yes. Yeah, it's not who we are as humans, right? It's not who we are as animals.
Although one study I read about in The Guardian, which is always where I read about these things, they said that that scientists studied the effect of words on the brain depending on how they come in. And when they rhyme and when they're sung, they go straight to the emotional centers of the brain, get processed very differently. And that's kind of obvious for any of us performers out there, you know, but they confirmed that.
Yeah. They had to have the scientists confirm it.
It always helped some people.
That's the hallmark of academia. It takes one scientist to tell you 1,000 people already.
Well,
say that again,
Ellie.
One scientist, what?
The hallmark of academia is it takes one expert to tell you what 1,000 regular people already knew.
Yeah. So. Well, this has been a wonderful little discussion. I want to talk more. An hour is just never enough time, but it's been great having you all on. And
thanks for having us on. And I hope everybody will read the Anarchist Review of Books. It's going to be out in December, going out to all Fifth Estate subscribers and available wherever Fifth Estate can be purchased. And we're very, very excited to be bringing it to you and very thankful for Peter Werby and the FE Collective for handing this over to us.
It's excellent and good, and everybody should pick up the current issue of Fifth Estate as well while they're at it.
Correct, of course.
Okay, I'll talk to you all again. Thanks again.
Thank you.
And thank you all for tuning in to another edition of Fifth Estate Live, which you can hear every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, Cable Community Radio, and elsewhere. You'll find all the Fifth Estate Live episodes at fifthestate.org, where you can also subscribe to the physical magazine. You can find these interviews and my other interviews archived in various places in the Discussions with David playlist at youtube.com/drovix and in audio form at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, where you can also support my broadcasting efforts and check out lots of other content, or if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. Those of you who tune in to my live stream programs via the Facebook page of Popular Resistance may already be aware that co-founder of Popular Resistance, longtime organizer, lawyer, podcaster, and visionary Kevin Zeis died suddenly at home early in the morning on September 5th. There will be a memorial for Kevin that you can view on the Facebook page of Popular Resistance on September 19th, and you can read more about that there as well. If you're somewhere in the region of Portland, Oregon, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up for text notifications to be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response to help us mobilize against the coming waves of evictions. Remember, don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. See you soon. Bye for now.